At last the carriages were ordered. Madame Verdurin said to Swann, "Goodbye, then. We shall see you soon, I hope." Trying, by the friendliness of her manner and the constraint of her smile, to prevent him from noticing that she was not saying, as she would always have until then, "Tomorrow, then, at Chateau, and at my house the day after." Monsieur and Madame Verdurin made Forcheville get into their carriage. Swann's was drawn up behind it, and he waited for theirs to start before helping Odette into his own.
"Odette, we'll take you," said Madame Verdurin. "We've kept a little corner specially for you, beside Monsieur de Forcheville."
"Yes, Madame Verdurin," said Odette meekly.
"What? I thought I was to take you home," cried Swann, flinging discretion to the winds, for the carriage door hung open, time was precious, and he could not in his present state go home without her.
"But Madame Verdurin has asked me."
"That's all right. You can quite well go home alone. We've left you like this dozens of times," said Madame Verdurin.
"But I had something important to tell Madame de Crécy."
"Very well, you can write it to her instead."
"Goodbye," said Odette, holding out her hand.
He tried hard to smile, but could only succeed in looking utterly dejected.
"What do you think of the airs that Swann is pleased to put on with us?" Madame Verdurin asked her husband when they had reached home. "I was afraid he was going to eat me, simply because we offered to take Odette back. It really is too bad, that sort of thing. Why doesn't he say straight out that we keep a disorderly house? I can't conceive how Odette can stand such manners. He positively seems to be saying all the time, 'You belong to me.' I shall tell Odette exactly what I think about it all, and I hope she will have the sense to understand me."
A moment later she added, inarticulate with rage,
"No, but don't you see, the filthy creature!"
Using unconsciously, and perhaps in satisfaction, of the same obscure need to justify herself, like Françoise at Cambrai when the chicken refused to die, the very words which the last convulsions of an inoffensive animal in its death agony wring from the peasant who is engaged in taking its life. And when Madame Verdurin's carriage had moved on, and Swann's took its place, his coachman, catching sight of his face, asked whether he was unwell or had heard bad news. Swann sent him away. He preferred to walk, and it was on foot through the bois that he came home. He talked to himself aloud, and in the same slightly affected tone which he had been used to adopt when describing the charms of the little nucleus and extolling the magnanimity of the Verdurins. But just as the conversation, the smiles, the kisses of Odette became as odious to him as he had once found them charming if they were diverted to others than himself, so the Verdurin's drawing-room, which not an hour before had still seemed to him amusing, inspired with a genuine feeling for art and even with a sort of moral aristocracy, now that it was another than himself whom Odette was going to meet there, to love there without restraint, laid bare to him all its absurdities, its stupidity, its shame. He drew a fanciful picture, at which he shuddered in disgust, of the party next evening at Chateau. Imagine going to Chateau, of all places, like a lot of drapers after closing time. Upon my word, these people are sublime in their smugness. They can't really exist. They must all have come out of one of Labiche's plays. The Cottards would be there, possibly Brichot. Could anything be more grotesque than the lives of these little creatures hanging on to one another like that? They'd imagine they were utterly lost, upon my soul they would, if they didn't all meet again tomorrow at Chateau. Alas, there would be the painter there also, the painter who enjoyed matchmaking, who would invite Forcheville to come with Odette to his studio. He could see Odette in a dress far too smart for the country, for she is so vulgar in that way, and poor little thing, she is such a fool. He could hear the jokes that Madame Verdurin would make after dinner, jokes which, whoever the bore might be at whom they were aimed, had always amused him because he could watch Odette laughing at them, laughing with him, her laughter almost a part of his. Now he felt that it was possibly at him that they would make Odette laugh. "What a fetid form of humour!" he exclaimed, twisting his mouth into an expression of disgust so violent that he could feel the muscles of his throat stiffen against his collar. "How, in God's name, can a creature made in his image find anything to laugh at in those nauseating witticisms? The least sensitive nose must be driven away in horror from such stale exhalations. It is really impossible to believe that any human being is incapable of understanding that, in allowing herself merely to smile at the expense of a fellow creature who has loyally held out his hand to her, she is casting herself into a mire from which it will be impossible, with the best will in the world, ever to rescue her. I dwell so many miles above the puddles in which these filthy little vermin sprawl and crawl and bawl their cheap obscenities, that I cannot possibly be spattered by the witticisms of a Verdurin," he cried, tossing up his head and arrogantly straightening his body. "God knows that I have honestly attempted to pull Odette out of that sewer and to teach her to breathe a nobler and a purer air. But human patience has its limits, and mine is at an end," he concluded, as though this sacred mission to tear Odette away from an atmosphere of sarcasms dated from longer than a few minutes ago, as though he had not undertaken it only since it had occurred to him that those sarcasms might perchance be directed at himself and might have the effect of detaching Odette from him. He could see the pianist sitting down to play the Moonlight Sonata, and the grimaces of Madame Verdurin in terrified anticipation of the wrecking of her nerves by Beethoven's music. "Idiot! Liar!" he shouted. "And a creature like that imagines that she's fond of art!" she would say to Odette, after deftly insinuating a few words of praise for Forcheville, as she had so often done for himself. "You can make room for Monsieur de Forcheville there, can't you, Odette?" "In the dark! Codfish! Panda!" Panda was the name he applied also to the music, which would invite them to sit in silence, to dream together, to gaze in each other's eyes, to feel for each other's hands. He felt that there was much to be said, after all, for a sternly censorious attitude towards the arts, such as Plato adopted, and Bossuet, and the old school of education in France. In a word, the life which they led at the Verdurins, which he had so often described as genuine, seemed to him now the worst possible form of life, and their little nucleus the most degraded class of society. "It really is," he repeated, "beneath the lowest rung of the social ladder, the nethermost circle of Dante. Beyond a doubt, the august words of the Florentine refer to the Verdurins. When one comes to think of it, surely people in society, and though one may find fault with them now and then, still, after all, they are a very different matter from that gang of blackmailers, show a profound sagacity in refusing to know them, or even to dirty the tips of their fingers with them. What a sound intuition there is in that noli me tangere motto of the Faubourg Saint-Germain." He had long since emerged from the paths and avenues of the Bois. He had almost reached his own house, and still, for he had not yet thrown off the intoxication of grief or his whim of insincerity, but was ever more and more exhilarated by the false intonation, the artificial sonority of his own voice, he continued to perorate aloud in the silence of the night, "People in society have their failings, as no one knows better than I. But after all, they are people to whom some things at least are impossible. So-and-so, a fashionable woman whom he had known, was far from being perfect, but after all, one did find in her a fundamental delicacy, a loyalty in her conduct which made her, whatever happened, incapable of a felony, which fixes a vast gulf between her and an old hag like Verdurin. Verdurin, what a name! Oh, there's something complete about them, something almost fine in their trueness to type. They're the most perfect specimens of their disgusting class. Thank God, it was high time that I stopped condescending to promiscuous intercourse with such infamy, such dung.
But just as the virtues which he had still attributed an hour or so earlier to the Verdurins would not have sufficed, even although the Verdurins had actually possessed them, if they had not also favoured and protected his love, to excite Swann to that state of intoxication in which he waxed tender over their magnanimity, an intoxication which, even when disseminated through the medium of other persons, could have come to him from Odette alone. So the immorality, had it really existed, which he now found in the Verdurins, would have been powerless if they had not invited Odette with Forcheville and without him to unstop the vials of his wrath and to make him scarify their infamy. Doubtless Swann's voice showed a finer perspicacity than his own when it refused to utter those words full of disgust at the Verdurins and their circle, and of joy at his having shaken himself free of it, save in an artificial and rhetorical tone, and as though his words had been chosen rather to appease his anger than to express his thoughts. The latter, in fact, while he abandoned himself to invective, were probably, though he did not know it, occupied with a wholly different matter, for once he had reached his house, no sooner had he closed the front door behind him than he struck his forehead, and making his servant open the door again, dashed out into the street, shouting, in a voice which this time was quite natural, "I believe I've found a way of getting invited to the dinner at Chateau tomorrow." But it must have been a bad way, for Monsieur Swann was not invited. Dr. Cottard, who, having been summoned to attend a serious case in the country, had not seen the Verdurins for some days, and had been prevented from appearing at Chateau, said on the evening after this dinner, as he sat down to table at their house, "Why, aren't we going to see Monsieur Swann this evening? He is quite what you might call a personal friend." "I sincerely trust that we shan't," cried Madame Verdurin. "Heaven preserve us from him! He's too deadly for words, a stupid, ill-bred boor." On hearing these words, Cottard exhibited an intense astonishment blended with entire submission, as though in the face of a scientific truth which contradicted everything that he had previously believed, but was supported by an irresistible weight of evidence. With timorous emotion he bowed his head over his plate and merely replied, "Oh, oh, 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 oh." Traversing, in an orderly retirement of his forces, into the depths of his being, along a descending scale, the whole compass of his voice. After which there was no more talk of Swann at the Verdurins. And so that drawing-room which had brought Swann and Odette together became an obstacle in the way of their meeting. She no longer said to him, as she had said in the early days of their love, "We shall meet anyhow tomorrow evening. There's a supper-party at the Verdurins." But, "We shan't be able to meet tomorrow evening. There's a supper-party at the Verdurins." Or else the Verdurins were taking her to the Opéra Comique to see Une Nuit de Cléopâtre, and Swann could read in her eyes that terror lest he should ask her not to go, which, but a little time before, he could not have refrained from greeting with a kiss as it flitted across the face of his mistress, but which now exasperated him. "Yet I'm not really angry," he assured himself, "when I see how she longs to run away and scratch from maggots in that dunghill of cacophony. I'm disappointed, not for myself, but for her. Disappointed to find that after living for more than 6 months in daily contact with myself, she has not been capable of improving her mind, even to the point of spontaneously eradicating from it a taste for Victor Massé. More than that,
To find that she has not arrived at the stage of understanding that there are evenings on which anyone with the least shade of refinement of feeling should be willing to forego an amusement when she's asked to do so. She ought to have the sense to say, I shall not go, if it were only from policy, since it is by what she answers now that the quality of her soul will be determined once and for all. And having persuaded himself that it was solely, after all, in order that he might arrive at a favourable estimate of Odette's spiritual worth that he wished her to stay at home with him that evening instead of going to the Opéra Comique, he adopted the same line of reasoning with her, with the same degree of insincerity as he had used with himself, or even with a degree more, for in her case he was yielding also to the desire to capture her by her own self-esteem. I swear to you, he told her shortly before she was to leave for the theatre, that in asking you not to go, I should hope, were I a selfish man, for nothing so much as that you should refuse. For I have 1,000 other things to do this evening, and I shall feel that I have been tricked and trapped myself, and shall be thoroughly annoyed if, after all, you tell me that you are not going. But my occupations, my pleasures, are not everything. I must think of you also. A day may come when, seeing me irrevocably sundered from you, you will be entitled to reproach me for not having warned you at the decisive hour in which I felt that I was going to pass judgment on you, one of those stern judgments which love cannot long resist. You see, your Nuit de Cléopâtre, what a title, has no bearing on the point. What I must know is whether you are indeed one of those creatures in the lowest grade of mentality and even of charm, one of those contemptible creatures who are incapable of foregoing a pleasure. For if you are such, how could anyone love you? For you are not even a person, a definite, imperfect, but at least perceptible entity. You are a formless water that will trickle down any slope that it may come upon, a fish devoid of memory, incapable of thought, which all its life long in its aquarium will continue to dash itself 100 times a day against a wall of glass, always mistaking it for water. Do you realize that your answer will have the effect, I do not say of making me cease from that moment to love you, that goes without saying, but of making you less attractive to my eyes when I realize that you are not a person, that you are beneath everything in the world and have not the intelligence to raise yourself one inch higher? Obviously, I should have preferred to ask you, as though it had been a matter of little or no importance, to give up your Nuit de Cléopâtre, since you compel me to sully my lips with so abject a name, in the hope that you would go to it none the less. But since I had resolved to weigh you in the balance, to make so grave an issue depend upon your answer, I consider it more honourable to give you due warning. Meanwhile, Odette had shown signs of increasing emotion and uncertainty. Although the meaning of his tirade was beyond her, she grasped that it was to be included among the scenes of reproach or supplication, scenes which her familiarity with the ways of men enabled her, without paying any heed to the words that were uttered, to conclude that men would not make unless they were in love, that from the moment when they were in love it was superfluous to obey them, since they would only be more in love later on. And so she would have heard Swann out with the utmost tranquillity, had she not noticed that it was growing late, and that if he went on speaking for any length of time, she would never, as she told him with a fond smile, obstinate but slightly abashed, get there in time for the overture. On other occasions he had assured himself that the one thing which, more than anything else, would make him cease to love her would be her refusal to abandon the habit of lying. Even from the point of view of coquetry pure and simple, he had told her, can't you see how much of your attraction you throw away when you stoop to lying? By a frank admission, how many faults you might redeem. Really, you are far less intelligent than I supposed. In vain, however, did Swann expound to her thus all the reasons that she had for not lying. They might have succeeded in overthrowing any universal system of mendacity, but Odette had no such system. She contented herself merely, whenever she wished Swan to remain in ignorance of anything that she had done, with not telling him of it. So that a lie was to her something to be used only as a special expedient, and the one thing that could make her decide whether she should avail herself of a lie or not was a reason which, too, was of a special and contingent order, namely, the risk of Swan's discovering that she had not told him the truth. Physically, she was passing through an unfortunate phase. She was growing stouter, and the expressive, sorrowful charm, the surprised, wistful expressions which she had formerly had, seemed to have vanished with her first youth, with the result that she became most precious to Swan at the very moment when he found her distinctly less good-looking. He would gaze at her for hours on end, trying to recapture the charm which he had once seen in her and could not find again. And yet the knowledge that within this new and strange chrysalis it was still Odette that lurked, still the same volatile temperament, artful and evasive, was enough to keep Swan seeking with as much passion as ever to captivate her. Then he would look at photographs of her taken 2 years before, and would remember how exquisite she had been, and that would console him a little for all the sufferings that he voluntarily endured on her account. When the Verdurins took her off to Saint-Germain, or to Chatou, or to Melun, as often as not, if the weather was fine, they would propose to remain there for the night and not go home until next day. Madame Verdurin would endeavour to set at rest the scruples of the pianist whose aunt had remained in Paris.
"She will be only too glad to be rid of you for a day. How on earth could she be anxious when she knows you're with us? Anyhow, I'll take you all under my wing. She can put the blame on me."
If this attempt failed, Monsieur Verdurin would set off across country until he came to a telegraph office or some other kind of messenger, after first finding out which of the faithful had anyone whom they must warn. But Odette would thank him and assure him that she had no message for anyone, for she had told Swan, once and for all, that she could not possibly send messages to him before all those people without compromising herself. Sometimes she would be absent for several days on end, when the Verdurins took her to see the tombs at Dreux, or to Compiègne, on the painter's advice, to watch the sun setting through the forest, after which they went on to the château of Pierrefonds. To think that she could visit really historic buildings with me, who have spent 10 years in the study of architecture, who am constantly bombarded by people who rarely count to take them over Beauvais or Saint-Loup-de-Neau, and refuse to take anyone but her. And instead of that, she trundles off with the lowest, the most brutally degraded of creatures, to go into ecstasies over the petrified excretions of Louis-Philippe and Viollet-le-Duc. One hardly needs much knowledge of art, I should say, to do that, though surely even without any particularly refined sense of smell, one would not deliberately choose to spend a holiday in the latrines so as to be within range of their fragrant exhalations. But when she had set off for Dreux or Pierrefonds, alas, without allowing him to appear there, as though by accident at her side, for, as she said, that would create a dreadful impression, he would plunge into the most intoxicating romance in the lover's library, the railway timetable, from which he learned the ways of joining her there in the afternoon, in the evening, even in the morning. The ways, more than that, the authority, the right to join her. For after all, the timetable and the trains themselves were not meant for dogs. If the public were carefully informed by means of printed advertisements that at 8 o'clock in the morning a train started for Pierrefonds, which arrived there at 10, that could only be because going to Pierrefonds was a lawful act, for which permission from Odette would be superfluous. An act, moreover, which might be performed from a motive altogether different from the desire to see Odette, since persons who had never even heard of her performed it daily, and in such numbers as justified the labour and expense of stoking the engines. So it came to this, that she could not prevent him from going to Pierrefonds if he chose to do so. Now, that was precisely what he found that he did choose to do, and would at that moment be doing, were he, like the travelling public, not acquainted with Odette. For a long time past, he had wanted to form a more definite impression of Viollet-le-Duc's work as a restorer. And the weather being what it was, he felt an overwhelming desire to spend the day roaming in the forest of Compiègne. It was, indeed, a piece of bad luck that she had forbidden him access to the one spot that tempted him today. Today? Why, if he went down there in defiance of her prohibition, he would be able to see her that very day. But then, whereas if she had met at Pierrefonds someone who did not matter, she would have hailed him with obvious pleasure. What, you here? And would have invited him to come and see her at the hotel where she was staying with the Verdurins. If, on the other hand, it was himself, Swann, that she encountered there, she would be annoyed, would complain that she was being followed, would love him less in consequence, might even turn away in anger when she caught sight of him. "So then, I am not to be allowed to go away for a day anywhere," she would reproach him on her return, whereas, in fact, it was he himself who was not allowed to go. He had had the sudden idea, so as to contrive to visit Compiègne and Pierrefonds without letting it be supposed that his object was to meet Odette, of securing an invitation from one of his friends, the Marquis de Forestel, who had a country house in that neighbourhood. This friend, to whom Swann suggested the plan without disclosing its ulterior purpose, was beside himself with joy. He did not conceal his astonishment at Swann's consenting at last, after 15 years, to come down and visit his property, and since he did not, he told him, wish to stay there, promised to spend some days at least in taking him for walks and excursions in the district. Swann imagined himself down there already with Monsieur de Forestel. Even before he saw Odette, even if he did not succeed in seeing her there, what a joy it would be to set foot on that soil where, not knowing the exact spot in which at any moment she was to be found, he would feel all around him the thrilling possibility of her suddenly appearing. In the courtyard of the chateau, now beautiful in his eyes since it was on her account that he had gone to visit it, in all the streets of the town, which struck him as romantic, down every ride of the forest, roseate with the deep and tender glow of sunset, innumerable and alternative hiding places to which would fly simultaneously for refuge in the uncertain ubiquity of his hopes, his happy, vagabond and divided heart. "We mustn't on any account," he would warn Monsieur de Forestel, "run across Odette and the Verdurins. I have just heard that they are at Pierrefonds, of all places, today. One has plenty of time to see them in Paris. It would hardly be worthwhile coming down here if one couldn't go a yard without meeting them." And his host would fail to understand why, once they had reached the place, Swann would change his plans 20 times in an hour, inspect the dining rooms of all the hotels in Compiègne without being able to make up his mind to settle down in any of them, although he had found no trace anywhere of the Verdurins, seemed to be in search of what he had claimed to be most anxious to avoid, and would, in fact, avoid the moment he found it, for if he had come upon the little group, he would have hastened away at once with studied indifference, satisfied that he had seen Odette and she him, especially that she had seen him when he was not, apparently, thinking about her. But no. She would guess at once that it was for her sake that he had come there. And when Monsieur de Forestel came to fetch him, and it was time to start, he excused himself. "No, I'm afraid not. I can't go to Pierrefonds today. You see, Odette is there." And Swann was happy, in spite of everything, in feeling that if he, alone among mortals, had not the right to go to Pierrefonds that day, it was because he was, in fact, for Odette, someone who differed from all other mortals, her lover. And because that restriction, which for him alone was set upon the universal right to travel freely where one would, was but one of the many forms of that slavery, that love which was so dear to him. Decidedly, it was better not to risk a quarrel with her, to be patient, to wait for her return. He spent his days in poring over a map of the forest of Compiègne as though it had been that of the Pays du Tendre. He surrounded himself with photographs of the Château of Pierrefonds. When the day dawned on which it was possible that she might return, he opened the timetable again, calculated what train she must have taken, and, should she have postponed her departure, what trains were still left for her to take. He did not leave the house, for fear of missing a telegram. He did not go to bed in case, having come by the last train, she decided to surprise him with a midnight visit. Yes, the front doorbell rang. There seemed some delay in opening the door. He wanted to awaken the porter. He leaned out of the window to shout to Odette, if it was Odette, for in spite of the orders which he had gone downstairs a dozen times to deliver in person, they were quite capable of telling her that he was not at home. It was only a servant coming in. He noticed the incessant rumble of passing carriages, to which he had never before paid any attention. He could hear them, one after another, a long way off, coming nearer, passing his door without stopping, and bearing away into the distance a message which was not for him. He waited all night to no purpose, for the Verdurins had returned unexpectedly, and Odette had been in Paris since midday. It had not occurred to her to tell him. Not knowing what to do with herself, she had spent the evening alone at a theatre, had long since gone home to bed, and was peacefully asleep. As a matter of fact, she had never given him a thought. And such moments as these, in which she forgot Swann's very existence, were of more value to Odette, did more to attach him to her than all her infidelities. For in this way, Swann was kept in that state of painful agitation which had once before been effective in making his interest blossom into love. On the night when he had failed to find Odette at the Verdurins and had hunted for her all evening. And he did not have, as I had afterwards at Cambrai in my childhood, happy days in which to forget the sufferings that would return with the night. For his days, Swann must pass them without Odette, and as he told himself now and then, to allow so pretty a woman to go out by herself in Paris was just as rash as to leave a case filled with jewels in the middle of the street. In this mood he would scowl furiously at the passers-by, as though they were so many pickpockets. But their faces, a collective and formless mass, escaped the grasp of his imagination, and so failed to feed the flame of his jealousy. The effort exhausted Swann's brain, until, passing his hand over his eyes, he cried out, "Heaven help me!" As people, after lashing themselves into an intellectual frenzy in their endeavours to master the problem of the reality of the external world, or that of the immortality of the soul, afford relief to their weary brains by an unreasoning act of faith. But the thought of his absent mistress was incessantly, indissolubly blended with all the simplest actions of Swann's daily life, when he took his meals, opened his letters, went for a walk or to bed, by the fact of his regret at having to perform those actions without her. Like those initials of Philibert the Fair, which in the church of Brou, because of her grief, her longing for him, Margaret of Austria intertwined everywhere with her own. On some days, instead of staying at home, he would go for luncheon to a restaurant not far off, to which he had been attracted some time before by the excellence of its cookery, but to which he now went only for one of those reasons at once mystical and absurd, which people call romantic, because this restaurant, which, by the way, still exists, bore the same name as the street in which Odette lived, the La Pérouse. Sometimes, when she had been away on a short visit somewhere, several days would elapse before she thought of letting him know that she had returned to Paris. And then she would say quite simply, without taking, as she would once have taken, the precaution of covering herself at all costs with a little fragment borrowed from the truth, that she had just at that very moment arrived by the morning train. What she said was a falsehood, at least for Odette it was a falsehood, inconsistent, lacking, what it would have had, if true, the support of her memory of her actual arrival at the station. She was even prevented from forming a mental picture of what she was saying while she said it by the contradictory picture in her mind of whatever quite different thing she had indeed been doing at the moment when she pretended to have been alighting from the train. In Swann's mind, however, these words, meeting no opposition, settled and hardened until they assumed the indestructibility of a truth so indubitable that, if some friend happened to tell him that he had come by the same train and had not seen Odette, Swann would have been convinced that it was his friend who had made the mistake as to the day or hour, since his version did not agree with the words uttered by Odette. These words had never appeared to him false, except when, before hearing them, he had suspected that they were going to be. For him to believe that she was lying, an anticipatory suspicion was indispensable. It was also, however, sufficient. Given that, everything that Odette might say appeared to him suspect. Did she mention a name? It was obviously that of one of her lovers. Once this supposition had taken shape, he would spend weeks in tormenting himself. On one occasion he even approached a firm of inquiry agents to find out the address and the occupation of the unknown rival, who would give him no peace until he could be proved to have gone abroad, and who, he ultimately learned, was an uncle of Odette and had been dead for 20 years. Although she would not allow him as a rule to meet her at public gatherings, saying that people would talk, it happened occasionally that at an evening party, to which he and she had each been invited, at Forcheville's, at the painter's, or at a charity ball given in one of the ministries, he found himself in the same room with her. He could see her, but dared not remain for fear of annoying her by seeming to be spying upon the pleasures which she tasted in other company. Pleasures which, while he drove home in utter loneliness and went to bed as anxiously as I myself was to go to bed some years later, on the evenings when he came to dine with us at Combray, seemed illimitable to him since he had not been able to see their end. And once or twice he derived from such evenings that kind of happiness which one would be inclined, did it not originate in so violent a reaction from an anxiety abruptly terminated, to call peaceful, since it consists in a pacifying of the mind. He had looked in for a moment at a revel in the painter's studio, and was getting ready to go home. He was leaving behind him Odette, transformed into a brilliant stranger, surrounded by men to whom her glances and her gaiety, which were not for him, seemed to hint at some voluptuous pleasure to be enjoyed there or elsewhere, possibly at the Bal des Incoherents, to which he trembled to think that she might be going on afterwards, which made Swann more jealous than the thought of their actual physical union, since it was more difficult to imagine. He was opening the door to go when he heard himself called back in these words, which, by cutting off from the party that possible ending which had so appalled him, made the party itself seem innocent in retrospect, made Odette's return home a thing no longer inconceivable and terrible, but tender and familiar, a thing that kept close to his side like a part of his own daily life in his carriage,
a thing that stripped Odette herself of the excessive brilliance and gaiety in her appearance, showed that it was only a disguise which she had assumed for a moment, for his sake and not in view of any mysterious pleasures, a disguise of which she had already wearied. In these words, which Odette flung out after him as he was crossing the threshold,
"Can't you wait a minute for me? I'm just going. We'll drive back together and you can drop me."
It was true that on one occasion Forcheville had asked to be driven home at the same time, but when, on reaching Odette's gate, he had begged to be allowed to come in too, she had replied with a finger pointed at Swann,
"Ah, that depends on this gentleman. You must ask him." "Very well, you may come in just for a minute if you insist, but you mustn't stay long, for I warn you, he likes to sit and talk quietly with me, and he's not at all pleased if I have visitors when he's here. Oh, if you only knew the creature as I know him. Isn't that so, my love? There's no one that really knows you, is there? Except me."
And Swann was, perhaps, even more touched by the spectacle of her addressing him thus in front of Forcheville, not only in these tender words of predilection, but also with certain criticisms such as,
"I feel sure you haven't written yet to your friends about dining with them on Sunday. You needn't go if you don't want to, but you might at least be polite." Or, "Now have you left your essay on Vermeer here, so that you can do a little more to it tomorrow? What a lazy bones! I'm going to make you work, I can tell you."
Which proved that Odette kept herself in touch with his social engagements and his literary work, that they had indeed a life in common. And as she spoke, she bestowed on him a smile which he interpreted as meaning that she was entirely his. And then, while she was making them some orangeade, suddenly, just as when the reflector of a lamp that is badly fitted begins by casting all round an object, on the wall beyond it, huge and fantastic shadows which in time contract and are lost in the shadow of the object itself, all the terrible and disturbing ideas which he had formed of Odette melted away and vanished in the charming creature who stood there before his eyes. He had the sudden suspicion that this hour spent in Odette's house in the lamplight was perhaps, after all, not an artificial hour, invented for his special use, with the object of concealing that frightening and delicious thing which was incessantly in his thoughts without his ever being able to form a satisfactory impression of it, an hour of Odette's real life, of her life when he was not there, looking on, with theatrical properties and pasteboard fruits, but was perhaps a genuine hour of Odette's life. That if he himself had not been there, she would have pulled forward the same armchair for Forcheville, would have poured out for him not any unknown brew, but precisely that orangeade which she was now offering to them both. That the world inhabited by Odette was not that other world, fearful and supernatural, in which he spent his time in placing her, and which existed perhaps only in his imagination, but the real universe, exhaling no special atmosphere of gloom, comprising that table at which he might sit down presently and write, and this drink which he was being permitted now to taste. All the objects which he contemplated with as much curiosity and admiration as gratitude, for if, in absorbing his dreams, they had delivered him from an obsession, they themselves were, in turn, enriched by the absorption. They showed him the palpable realization of his fancies, and they interested his mind. They took shape and grew solid before his eyes, and at the same time they soothed his troubled heart. Ah, had fate but allowed him to share a single dwelling with Odette, so that in her house he should be in his own. If, when asking his servant what there would be for luncheon, it had been Odette's bill of fare that he had learned from the reply,
If, when Odette wished to go for a walk in the morning along the Avenue du Bois de Boulogne, his duty as a good husband had obliged him, though he had no desire to go out, to accompany her, carrying her cloak when she was too warm. And in the evening after dinner, if she wished to stay at home and not to dress, if he had been forced to stay beside her, to do what she asked. Then, how completely would all the trivial details of Swann's life, which seemed to him now so gloomy, simply because they would at the same time have formed part of the life of Odette, have taken on, like that lamp, that orangeade, that armchair, which had absorbed so much of his dreams, which materialized so much of his longing, a sort of superabundant sweetness and a mysterious solidity. And yet he was inclined to suspect that the state for which he so much longed was a calm, a peace, which would not have created an atmosphere favourable to his love. When Odette ceased to be for him a creature always absent, regretted, imagined, when the feeling that he had for her was no longer the same mysterious disturbance that was wrought in him by the phrase from the sonata, but constant affection and gratitude, when those normal relations were established between them which would put an end to his melancholy madness, then, no doubt, the actions of Odette's daily life would appear to him as being of but little intrinsic interest, as he had several times already felt that they might be, on the day, for instance, when he had read through its envelope her letter to Forcheville. Examining his complaint with as much scientific detachment as if he had inoculated himself with it in order to study its effects, he told himself that when he was cured of it, what Odette might or might not do would be indifferent to him. But in his morbid state, to tell the truth, he feared death itself no more than such a recovery, which would, in fact, amount to the death of all that he then was. After these quiet evenings, Swann's suspicions would be temporarily lulled. He would bless the name of Odette, and next day in the morning would order the most attractive jewels to be sent to her, because her kindnesses to him overnight had excited either his gratitude or the desire to see them repeated, or a paroxysm of love for her which had need of some such outlet. But at other times grief would again take hold of him. He would imagine that Odette was Forcheville's mistress, and that when they had both sat watching him from the depths of the Verdurin's landau in the Bois on the evening before the party at Chatou, to which he had not been invited, while he implored her in vain with that look of despair on his face which even his coachman had noticed to come home with him, and then turned away, solitary, crushed, she must have employed to draw Forcheville's attention to him while she murmured, "Do look at him storming." The same glance, brilliant, malicious, sidelong, cunning, as on the evening when Forcheville had driven Sagnette from the Verdurins. At such times Swann detested her. "But I've been a fool, too," he would argue. "I'm paying for other men's pleasures with my money. All the same, she'd better take care and not pull the string too often, for I might very well stop giving her anything at all. At any rate, we'd better knock off supplementary favours for the time being. To think that only yesterday, when she said she would like to go to Bayreuth for the season, I was such an ass as to offer to take her to one of those jolly little places the King of Bavaria has there, for the two of us. However, she didn't seem particularly keen. She hasn't said yes or no yet. Let's hope that she'll refuse. Good God! Think of listening to Wagner for a fortnight on end with her, who takes about as much interest in music as a fish does in little apples. It will be fun." And his hatred, like his love, needing to manifest itself in action, he amused himself with urging his evil imaginings further and further, because, thanks to the perfidies with which he charged Odette, he detested her still more, and would be able, if it turned out, as he tried to convince himself, that she was indeed guilty of them, to take the opportunity of punishing her, emptying upon her the overflowing vials of his wrath.
In this way, he went so far as to suppose that he was going to receive a letter from her, in which she would ask him for money to take the house at Bayreuth, but with the warning that he was not to come there himself, as she had promised Forcheville and the Verdurins to invite them. Oh, how he would have loved it, had it been conceivable that she would have that audacity! What joy he would have in refusing, in drawing up that vindictive reply, the terms of which he amused himself by selecting and declaiming aloud, as though he had actually received her letter. The very next day, her letter came. She wrote that the Verdurins and their friends had expressed a desire to be present at these performances of Wagner, and that if he would be so good as to send her the money, she would be able at last, after going so often to their house, to have the pleasure of entertaining the Verdurins in hers. Of him she said not a word. It was to be taken for granted that their presence at Bayreuth would be a bar to his. Then that annihilating answer, every word of which he had carefully rehearsed overnight, without venturing to hope that it could ever be used, he had the satisfaction of having it conveyed to her. Alas, he felt only too certain that with the money which she had, or could easily procure, she would be able all the same to take a house at Bayreuth, since she wished to do so, she who was incapable of distinguishing between Bach and Clapisson. Let her take it, then. She would have to live in it more frugally, that was all. No means, as there would have been if he had replied by sending her several thousand franc notes, of organizing each evening in her hired castle those exquisite little suppers after which she might perhaps be seized by the whim, which it was possible had never yet seized her, of falling into the arms of Forcheville. At any rate, this loathsome expedition, it would not be Swann who had to pay for it. Ah, if he could only manage to prevent it! If she could sprain her ankle before starting, if the driver of the carriage which was to take her to the station would consent, no matter how great the bribe, to smuggle her to some place where she could be kept for a time in seclusion, that perfidious woman, her eyes tinseled with a smile of complicity for Forcheville, which was what Odette had become for Swann in the last 48 hours. But she was never that for very long. After a few days, the shining, crafty eyes lost their brightness and their duplicity. That picture of an execrable Odette saying to Forcheville, "Look at him storming," began to grow pale and to dissolve. Then gradually reappeared and rose before him, softly radiant, the face of the other Odette, of that Odette who also turned with a smile to Forcheville, but with a smile in which there was nothing but affection for Swann, when she said, "You mustn't stay long, for this gentleman doesn't much like my having visitors when he's here. Oh, if you only knew the creature as I know him." That same smile with which she used to thank Swann for some instance of his courtesy which she prized so highly, for some advice for which she had asked him in one of those grave crises in her life, when she could turn to him alone. Then, to this other Odette, he would ask himself what could have induced him to write that outrageous letter, of which, probably until then, she had never supposed him capable, a letter which must have lowered him from the high, from the supreme place, which, by his generosity, by his loyalty, he had won for himself in her esteem. He would become less dear to her, since it was for those qualities which she found neither in Forcheville nor in any other that she loved him. It was for them that Odette so often showed him a reciprocal kindness, which counted for less than nothing in his moments of jealousy, because it was not a sign of reciprocal desire, was indeed a proof rather of affection than of love. But the importance of which he began once more to feel in proportion as the spontaneous relaxation of his suspicions, often accelerated by the distraction brought to him by reading about art or by the conversation of a friend, rendered his passion less exacting of reciprocities. Now that after this swing of the pendulum, Odette had naturally returned to the place from which Swann's jealousy had for the moment driven her, in the angle in which he found her charming, he pictured her to himself as full of tenderness, with a look of consent in her eyes, and so beautiful that he could not refrain from moving his lips towards her, as though she had actually been in the room for him to kiss. And he preserved a sense of gratitude to her for that bewitching, kindly glance, as strong as though she had really looked thus at him, and it had not been merely his imagination that had portrayed it in order to satisfy his desire. What distress he must have caused her! Certainly he found adequate reasons for his resentment, but they would not have been sufficient to make him feel that resentment if he had not so passionately loved her. Had he not nourished grievances just as serious against other women, to whom he would nonetheless render willing service today, feeling no anger towards them, because he no longer loved them? If the day ever came when he would find himself in the same state of indifference with regard to Odette, he would then understand that it was his jealousy alone which had led him to find something atrocious, unpardonable, in this desire, after all so natural a desire, springing from a childlike ingenuousness and also from a certain delicacy in her nature, to be able in her turn, when an occasion offered, to repay the Verdurins for their hospitality and to play the hostess in a house of her own. He returned to the other point of view, opposite to that of his love and of his jealousy, to which he resorted at times by a sort of mental equity, and in order to make allowance for different eventualities, from which he tried to form a fresh judgment of Odette, based on the supposition that he had never been in love with her, that she was to him just a woman like other women, that her life had not been, whenever he himself was not present, different. A texture woven in secret apart from him, and warped against him. Wherefore believe that she would enjoy down there with Forcheville, or with other men intoxicating pleasures which she had never known with him, and which his jealousy alone had fabricated in all their elements? At Bayreuth, as in Paris, if it should happen that Forcheville thought of him at all, it would only be as of someone who counted for a great deal in the life of Odette. Someone for whom he was obliged to make way when they met in her house. If Forcheville and she scored a triumph by being down there together in spite of him, it was he who had engineered that triumph by striving in vain to prevent her from going there. Whereas, if he had approved of her plan, which for that matter was quite defensible, she would have had the appearance of being there by his counsel. She would have felt herself sent there, housed there by him, and for the pleasure which she derived from entertaining those people who had so often entertained her, it was to him that she would have had to acknowledge her indebtedness. And if, instead of letting her go off thus at cross purposes with him, without having seen him again, he were to send her this money, if he were to encourage her to take this journey, and to go out of his way to make it comfortable and pleasant for her, she would come running to him, happy, grateful, and he would have the joy, the sight of her face, which he had not known for nearly a week, a joy which none other could replace. For the moment that Swann was able to form a picture of her without revulsion, that he could see once again the friendliness in her smile, and that the desire to tear her away from every rival was no longer imposed by his jealousy upon his love, that love once again became, more than anything, a taste for the sensations which Odette's person gave him, for the pleasure which he found in admiring, as one might a spectacle, or in questioning, as one might a phenomenon, the birth of one of her glances, the formation of one of her smiles, the utterance of an intonation of her voice. And this pleasure, different from every other, had in the end created in him a need of her, which she alone, by her presence or by her letters, could assuage, almost as disinterested, almost as artistic, as perverse as another need which characterized this new period in Swann's life, when the sereness, the depression of the preceding years had been followed by a sort of spiritual superabundance, without his knowing to what he owed this unlooked-for enrichment of his life, any more than a person in delicate health who from a certain moment grows stronger, puts on flesh, and seems for a time to be on the road to a complete recovery. This other need, which too developed in him independently of the visible material world, was the need to listen to music and to learn to know it. And so, by the chemical process of his malady, after he had created jealousy out of his love, he began again to generate tenderness, pity for Odette. She had become once more the old Odette, charming and kind. He was full of remorse for having treated her harshly. He wished her to come to him, and before she came, he wished to have already procured for her some pleasure, so as to watch her gratitude taking shape in her face and moulding her smile. So too Odette, certain of seeing him come to her in a few days, as tender and submissive as before, and plead with her for a reconciliation, became inured, was no longer afraid of displeasing him, or even of making him angry, and refused him, whenever it suited her, the favours by which he set most store. Perhaps she did not realise how sincere he had been with her during their quarrel, when he had told her that he would not send her any money, but would do what he could to hurt her. Perhaps she did not realise either how sincere he still was, if not with her, at any rate with himself, on other occasions when, for the sake of their future relations, to show Odette that he was capable of doing without her, that a rupture was still possible between them, he decided to wait some time before going to see her again. Sometimes several days had elapsed, during which she had caused him no fresh anxiety. And as, from the next few visits which he would pay her, he knew that he was likely to derive not any great pleasure, but more probably some annoyance which would put an end to the state of calm in which he found himself, he wrote to her that he was very busy, and would not be able to see her on any of the days that he had suggested. Meanwhile, a letter from her, crossing his, asked him to postpone one of those very meetings. He asked himself why. His suspicions, his grief again took hold of him. He could no longer abide, in the new state of agitation into which he found himself plunged, by the arrangements which he had made in his preceding state of comparative calm. He would run to find her, and would insist upon seeing her on each of the following days. And even if she had not written first, if she merely acknowledged his letter, it was enough to make him unable to rest without seeing her. For upsetting all Swann's calculations, Odette's acceptance had entirely changed his attitude. Like everyone who possesses something precious, so as to know what would happen if he ceased for a moment to possess it, he had detached the precious object from his mind, leaving, as he thought, everything else in the same state as when it was there. But the absence of one part from a whole is not only that. It is not simply a partial omission. It is a disturbance of all the other parts, a new state, which it was impossible to foresee from the old. But at other times, when Odette was on the point of going away for a holiday, it was after some trifling quarrel for which he had chosen the pretext that he decided not to write to her and not to see her until her return, giving the appearance, and expecting the reward, of a serious rupture, which she would perhaps regard as final, to a separation, the greater part of which was inevitable, since she was going away, which, in fact, he was merely allowing to start a little sooner than it must. At once he could imagine Odette, puzzled, anxious, distressed at having received neither visit nor letter from him, and this picture of her, by calming his jealousy, made it easy for him to break himself of the habit of seeing her. At odd moments, no doubt, in the furthest recesses of his brain, where his determination had thrust it away, and thanks to the length of the interval, the 3 weeks' separation to which he had agreed,
It was with pleasure that he would consider the idea that he would see Odette again on her return. But it was also with so little impatience that he began to ask himself whether he would not readily consent to the doubling of the period of so easy an abstinence. It had lasted so far but 3 days, a much shorter time than he had often before passed without seeing Odette, and without having, as on this occasion he had, premeditated a separation. And yet, there and then, some tiny trace of contrariety in his mind, or of weakness in his body, by inciting him to regard the present as an exceptional moment, one not to be governed by the rules, one in which prudence itself would allow him to take advantage of the soothing effects of a pleasure and to give his will, until the time should come when its efforts might serve any purpose, a holiday, suspended the action of his will, which ceased to exert its inhibitive control. Or without that even, the thought of some information for which he had forgotten to ask Odette, such as if she had decided in what colour she would have her carriage repainted, or, with regard to some investment, whether they were ordinary or preference shares that she wished him to buy. For it was all very well to show her that he could live without seeing her, but if, after that, the carriage had to be painted over again, if the shares produced no dividend, a fine lot of good he would have done. And suddenly, like a stretched piece of elastic which is let go, or the air in a pneumatic machine which is ripped open, the idea of seeing her again from the remote point in time to which it had been attached sprang back into the field of the present and of immediate possibilities. It sprang back thus without meeting any further resistance, so irresistible, in fact, that Swan had been far less unhappy in watching the end gradually approaching day by day of the fortnight which he must spend apart from Odette than he was when kept waiting 10 minutes while his coachman brought round the carriage which was to take him to her, minutes which he passed in transports of impatience and joy, in which he recaptured 1,000 times over to lavish on it all the wealth of his affection, that idea of his meeting with Odette, which by so abrupt a repercussion, at a moment when he supposed it so remote, was once more present and on the very surface of his consciousness. The fact was that this idea no longer found, as an obstacle in its course, the desire to contrive without further delay to resist its coming, which had ceased to have any place in Swan's mind since, having proved to himself, or so at least he believed, that he was so easily capable of resisting it, he no longer saw any inconvenience in postponing a plan of separation which he was now certain of being able to put into operation whenever he would. Furthermore, this idea of seeing her again came back to him adorned with a novelty, a seductiveness, armed with a virulence, all of which long habit had enfeebled, but which had acquired new vigour during this privation, not of 3 days, but of a fortnight, for a period of abstinence may be calculated by anticipation as having lasted already until the final date assigned to it, and had converted what had been until then a pleasure in store, which could easily be sacrificed, into an unlooked-for happiness which he was powerless to resist. Finally, the idea returned to him with its beauty enhanced by his own ignorance of what Odette might have thought, might perhaps have done on finding that he showed no sign of life, with the result that he was now going to meet with the entrancing revelation of an Odette almost unknown. But she, just as she had supposed that his refusal to send her money was only a feint, saw nothing but a pretext in the question which he came now to ask her about the repainting of her carriage or the purchase of stock. For she could not reconstruct the several phases of these crises through which he passed, and in the general idea which she formed of them, she made no attempt to understand their mechanism, looking only to what she knew beforehand, their necessary, never-failing and always identical termination. An imperfect idea, though possibly all the more profound in consequence, if one were to judge it from the point of view of Swan, who would doubtless have considered that Odette failed to understand him, just as a morphinomaniac or a consumptive, each persuaded that he has been thrown back, one by some outside event, at the moment when he was just going to shake himself free from his inveterate habit, the other by an accidental indisposition at the moment when he was just going to be finally cured, feels himself to be misunderstood by the doctor, who does not attach the same importance to these pretended contingencies, mere disguises, according to him, assumed so as to be perceptible by his patients, by the vice of one and the morbid state of the other, which in reality have never ceased to weigh heavily and incurably upon them while they were nursing their dreams of normality and health. And as a matter of fact, Swan's love had reached that stage at which the physician, and in the case of certain affections, the boldest of surgeons, ask themselves whether to deprive a patient of his vice or to rid him of his malady is still reasonable or indeed possible. Certainly, of the extent of this love, Swan had no direct knowledge. When he sought to measure it, it happened sometimes that he found it diminished, shrunken almost to nothing. For instance, the very moderate liking, amounting almost to dislike, which in the days before he was in love with Odette he had felt for her expressive features, her faded complexion, returned on certain days. "Really, I am making distinct headway," he would tell himself on the morrow. "When I come to think it over carefully, I find out that I got hardly any pleasure last night out of being in bed with her. It's an odd thing, but I actually thought her ugly." And certainly he was sincere. But his love extended a long way beyond the province of physical desire. Odette's person, indeed, no longer held any great place in it. When his eyes fell upon the photograph of Odette on his table, or when she came to see him, he had difficulty in identifying her face, either in the flesh or on the pasteboard, with the painful and continuous anxiety which dwelt in his mind. He would say to himself, almost with astonishment, "It is she," as when suddenly someone shows us in a detached, externalized form one of our own maladies, and we find in it no resemblance to what we are suffering. She? He tried to ask himself what that meant, for it is something like love, like death, rather than like those vague conceptions of maladies, a thing which one repeatedly calls in question in order to make oneself probe further into it, in the fear that the question will find no answer, that the substance will escape our grasp, the mystery of personality. And this malady, which was Swan's love, had so far multiplied, was so closely interwoven with all his habits, with all his actions, with his thoughts, his health, his sleep, his life, even with what he hoped for after his death, was so entirely one with him that it would have been impossible to wrest it away without almost entirely destroying him. As surgeons say, his case was past operation. By this love, Swan had been so far detached from all other interests that when by chance he reappeared in the world of fashion, reminding himself that his social relations, like a beautifully wrought setting, although she would not have been able to form any very exact estimate of its worth, might still add a little to his own value in Odette's eyes, as indeed they might have done had they not been cheapened by his love itself, which for Odette depreciated everything that it touched by seeming to denounce such things as less precious than itself, he would feel there, simultaneously with his distress at being in places and among people that she did not know, the same detached sense of pleasure as he would have derived from a novel or a painting in which were depicted the amusements of a leisured class, just as, at home, he used to enjoy the thought of the smooth efficiency of his household, the smartness of his own wardrobe and of his servants' liveries, the soundness of his investments, with the same relish as when he read in Saint-Simon, who was one of his favourite authors, of the machinery of daily life at Versailles, what Madame de Maintenon ate and drank, or the shrewd avarice and great pomp of Lully. And in the small extent to which this detachment was not absolute, the reason for this new pleasure which Swann was tasting was that he could emigrate for a moment into those few and distant parts of himself which had remained almost foreign to his love and to his pain. In this respect, the personality with which my great-aunt endowed him, of young Swann, as distinct from the more individual personality of Charles Swann, was that in which he now most delighted. Once when, because it was the birthday of the Princesse de Parme, and because she could often be of use indirectly to Odette by letting her have seats for galas and jubilees and all that sort of thing, he had decided to send her a basket of fruit, and was not quite sure where or how to order it, he had entrusted the task to a cousin of his mother, who, delighted to be doing a commission for him, had written to him, laying stress on the fact that she had not chosen all the fruit at the same place, but the grapes from Capot, whose speciality they were, the strawberries from Jauret, the pears from Chevet, who had always had the best, and soon every fruit visited and examined one by one by myself. And in the sequel, by the cordiality with which the princess thanked him, he had been able to judge of the flavour of the strawberries and of the ripeness of the pears. But most of all, that every fruit visited and examined one by one by myself had brought balm to his sufferings, by carrying his mind off to a region which he rarely visited, although it was his by right, as the heir of a rich and respectable middle-class family, in which had been handed down from generation to generation the knowledge of the right places and the art of ordering things from shops. Of a truth, he had too long forgotten that he was young Swann, not to feel when he assumed that part again for a moment a keener pleasure than he was capable of feeling at other times, when indeed he was grown sick of pleasure. And if the friendliness of the middle-class people, for whom he had never been anything else than young Swann, was less animated than that of the aristocrats, though more flattering for all that, since in the middle-class mind friendship is inseparable from respect, no letter from a royal personage offering him some princely entertainment could ever be so attractive to Swann as the letter which asked him to be a witness, or merely to be present at a wedding in the family of some old friends of his parents, some of whom have kept up with him, like my grandfather, who the year before these events had invited him to my mother's wedding, while others barely knew him by sight, but were, they thought, in duty bound to show civility to the son, to the worthy successor of the late Monsieur Swann. But by virtue of his intimacy already time-honoured with so many of them, the people of fashion, in a certain sense, were also a part of his house, his service, and his family. He felt, when his mind dwelt upon his brilliant connections, the same external support, the same solid comfort, as when he looked at the fine estate, the fine silver, the fine table linen which had come down to him from his forebears. And the thought that if he were seized by a sudden illness and confined to the house, the people whom his valet would instinctively run to find would be the Duc de Chartres, the Prince de Russe, the Duc de Luxembourg, and the Baron de Charlus, brought him the same consolation as our old Françoise derived from the knowledge that she would one day be buried in her own fine clothes marked with her name, not darned at all, or so exquisitely darned that it merely enhanced one's idea of the skill and patience of the sempstress, a shroud from the constant image of which in her mind's eye she drew a certain satisfactory sense, if not actually of wealth and prosperity, at any rate of self-esteem.